Hey everyone, welcome back. Welcome back to the Letters and Layers podcast, your award-winning podcast for all things books, mental health, wellness, life lessons, streams of consciousness, and everything in between. This is your host, Amaka. It is Saturday, January 31st, when I am recording. It is about 9:30-ish in the morning, and just wanted to make this the first thing I take care of so that I can go about my day and come back later and edit and post for you guys tomorrow. So how have I been doing? I have been hanging in. Honestly, I'm just glad this week is over. I can't even lie. I'm just glad this week is over. Was feeling a little bit, not overwhelmed, but emotionally heightened this week regarding some things. Part of it work-related, part of it family-related. And I know everything will be fine. But you kind of, you know, in the moment, you're just like, why is all this happening right now? It's really not worth getting into because it's not going to matter literally in a couple of weeks or even less. I'm just reminding myself that I am going through a major transition right now. I am 31 weeks today. And not only is this transition a transition into parenthood, but just a lot of my life is changing as a result. And that's going to mean day-to-day things are going to change too. Because when I'm looking at my life from a bird's eye view, there are major shifts happening. So that means, you know, when you kind of looking at the details, there will be changes as well. So just, you know, trying to remind myself that sometimes these transitions will stretch you and they will feel uncomfortable and it doesn't mean life is bad or anything. It might feel like it's too much in the moment, but I know I'm gonna look back at certain moments and just remember it as literally a snapshot, literally a glimpse into a moment in time in a huge life transition that will force growth, will force discomfort in the best way, and will force me to challenge myself in ways that I never knew possible. So that's pretty much it. I'm just reminding myself that it's part of the journey. So yeah, aside from that, what's giving me a lot of joy this week is Ari Lennox's new album, Vacancy. It has been on repeat. It's amazing. It's such a good album. Like, I think as far as I get nervous with new albums, because I'm just like, what if I don't like it? But like artists that I love, I always push through that because especially if they are consistently always putting out good music. Masego is one of those people for me. Ari has become one of those people for me. I gotta think, who else? Dochi puts out consistent music. I think Dochi was the best first listen I ever had. And Ari is up there too with Vacancy. She opens the album with a song called Mobbin' in DC, and it's very reminiscent of Chicago Boy from Shea Butter Baby, just the way the album opens with that song. It's a favorite, and it's a vibe. The album is a vibe. I'm definitely going to purchase the vinyl because you know me. If you've listened to past podcast episodes, you know I am very much about owning my favorite physical media because I don't trust society anymore. That's neither here nor there. Anyway, yes, favorite songs on the album, Mobbin' in DC, Pretzel Company, Horoscope, or maybe one other one, but those are my top four. So if you haven't listened to it, listen to it, stream it, buy it, support her. She's amazing. I love her. What I've also been enjoying is the new season of The Pitt, which is housed under HBO Max. They came out the gate, not playing games. I still rewatch season one. It's such a good show. It's such a good show. I'm not even surprised that they like literally swept all their most if not all of their award categories this season. I love Catherine Lanassa, who plays the charge nurse. I love Noah Wiley, who is Dr. Robbie. I never watched ER, but yeah, I love him in this role. I love all the residents, some more than others, but they all are part of the glue that makes the show what it is. So I would say those are the two major things that I'm enjoying right now. And yeah, I'm 31 weeks today. I don't want to say we're getting down to the wire, but we are kind of getting down to the wire. I was talking to my therapist on Monday and telling her how, like, the fact that this trimester ends with the baby on the other side of my body is like something that I'm struggling, not in a bad way, but it's like something like I really need to process. Cause like I got pregnant and then I was in first trimester, and then first trimester became second trimester, and then second trimester became third trimester. And like, as far as gestation is concerned, there are no more trimesters. So you mean to tell me there's going to be a baby? Like, this trimester is ending with a baby. Like, I'm going to be a mother. Like, there's going to be another human in this apartment. I know I might sound crazy, but it's just, I can't wrap my head around it. I can't. And I don't think I'll be able to fully wrap my head around that until he is here and I'm looking at him with my own eyes. And even then, I won't believe it. Even then. I feel him all the time. I feel him all the time. Yesterday, he had what I am pretty sure, I'm not like 95% sure, was hiccups. They were just like, they felt like involuntary movements in my stomach, and they were very rhythmic. And they lasted for a while, and I got so worried. I was like, oh God, my baby. I hope you're okay. Thankfully, after a few minutes, they stopped. And then they started again later, but then they stopped and he hasn't had them since. But still, even with these experiences, I'm just like, okay, well, yeah, my belly is moving. Yeah, there are baby products coming to my house like several times a week. Yeah, I'm planning for a baby shower. Yeah, this, that, and the other. But what do you mean there's a baby coming? I'm not even playing. That's kind of what I'm dealing with mentally. I remember the first ultrasound we were scheduled to go and do. And my husband was like, how are you feeling? And I was like, there's no way there's going to be a baby when they put that wand on my belly. Like, I couldn't fathom it. And yet, when we got into the ultrasound room and I laid on the chair and they squeezed the gel and they put the wand, he was in there and he was moving. So it's really, pregnancy is like nothing I've ever experienced in my whole life. If I'm blessed to experience it again, I'm curious what that will be like, if it will be like this one, if it will be different in its own way. But I'm very much trying to stay present in the moment with this one because it's my first and I will never have a first pregnancy again. And I'm just thankful to God and just feel a lot of gratitude for just him walking alongside me in this journey so far. And I know he's going to see me to the end, and I will see myself on the other side, healthy and whole with my baby, even though I won't believe that he's real. But that's just what it'll be. So obviously I will keep you guys in the loop. I didn't want to spend too much time on my personal update, even though I'm already at 11 minutes recording. This podcast episode is about Matriarch. Finally, we have arrived here. I've been talking about this book since summer 2025. I'm sorry that I've taken so long to get to this point, and I'm not finished. I just got to be honest with y'all. I think what really slowed down my momentum with Matriarch was when former Vice President Kamala Harris's book came out, and I really wanted to read it. So I paused on Matriarch. I read 107 Days. You guys, you know, the episode is out. The video is almost done. That will go out soon. So yeah, that really slowed my momentum with Matriarch. But I am saying on the podcast today that I will be done by the end of February with Matriarch. So what that'll mean is the February 15th episode will be a separate topic. I actually want to do, I'm not exactly sure what I want to talk about, but I think I know. I don't want to say it just in case I change my mind. But it'll be Matriarch today, and then the next episode will be unrelated entirely. And then the March 1st episode will be part two. And I'm saying it on the podcast that I will be done with Matriarch by the end of February, and we will be discussing it. It will be the March 1st published episode. You guys can hold me to it because I need the accountability. And I was reminded very delightfully that people really do listen to this podcast. So I'm using y'all as my accountability partners. I will be done with the book before the end of the month, and then we will discuss part two on March 1st. But I've really enjoyed Matriarch. You know, when you think of these public personas, you think of Beyonce, you think of Rihanna, you think of all these people, honestly, you think of how their public persona makes you feel. You might feel positive, you might feel negative, you might feel neutral. As far as Tina Knowles is concerned, Miss Tina Knowles, I didn't really feel any type of way towards her. And that's not, you know, a slight in the least. It's just, you know, I think I had more of a neutral disposition to her public persona. I don't follow her on Instagram. I follow Beyonce. I mean, I think I follow Solange, but I don't follow Miss Tina. Sometimes her content, you know, kind of seeps into my timeline. No issues. I have no issues with that. But, you know, I know her as Beyonce's mother. I know her as, yeah, essentially Beyonce's mother. I know her as someone who is fierce, into fashion, just has been an integral part of the foundation that is Beyonce, that was Destiny's Child. So honestly, when Matriarch came out, I wasn't so keen on reading it. I was like, oh, Miss Tina Knowles is putting out a book. Good for her. It wasn't until I started hearing how good the book is that I was becoming more convinced that I should probably purchase. A good friend of mine recommended that I listen to the dedication, like the initial part of the book where Beyonce and Solange and Kelly and I think Angie give dedications to Miss Tina. I did, and it was tear-jerking. And then I was in Connecticut for a weekend. I forget what for. I think I went to visit the same friend who suggested I listen. And then I went into one of the Black-owned bookstores that I know, and she had Matriarch there. So I was like, you know what? Black-owned bookstore, let's buy it. So I've had it since then. And it has been such a joy to read this book. It's beautifully written. And it makes you feel like she does not spare any detail. I'm sure even with the like almost 400 pages that this book is, practically 400 pages that this book is, I'm sure there's still so much she did not include. I mean, she's 70 plus, like that's a lot of life to put into words. So I'm sure there's still things, even by the time I finish, I'm sure there are things that we still won't know and we don't have to know. But what she has decided to share with the world in this book has been such a joy to read. She had such a rich childhood. She had such devoted parents in different ways. Her mom was devoted to her in the best way she knew to be. Her dad and her siblings, she has 3 immediate brothers, an immediate sister, and then she has half siblings. It's a lot to keep track, honestly. I'm thinking Butch, Skip, Larry are her brothers, and then Flo is her sister. Those are her like direct full-blooded siblings. And then she has Selena, her older sister, who her mom had with her former husband. And I'm blanking on his name, but he played a pretty important role in it wasn't a big part of the book, but there was a part of the book where her ex-husband really kind of came to their rescue. And when I say there, I mean Miss Tina's mom and dad and the kids. But yeah, she has her full-blooded, full siblings who I've mentioned. And then who's coming to mind now is, I believe her name is Selena. She is Miss Tina's half-sister from her mom's previous marriage. And then Selena has some children as well. And I believe Selena is Ronnie's mother, who is Miss Tina's beloved cousin, who was gay and passed away. So I hope I got that right. But yeah, I say that her childhood was rich because she had family all around her. She had community. She might not have come from the wealthiest family or even a middle-class family. I think the book reads like they, you know, struggled. They worked for literally every penny they had. But you can't tell me that Miss Tina, as a child, did not have the time of her life, did not have a blast with all her siblings, all her cousins, just the freedom that came with being a child during that time in the 1940s and 50s, having everyone live close in the same community, knowing your neighbors, everyone looking out for each other, especially since this is a time where racism is still rampant. They lived in Galveston, Texas, and everyone had to be their brother's keeper or their sister's keeper. So you really get that vibe in the book, especially in her childhood. Her mom did not play any games, but you can tell she tried to show her love in what she could do for them, and always praying. She was a praying mother, working herself to the bone, making clothes from scraps that she would get at fabric stores, you know, working whatever job she could, speaking life into her kids. Sometimes in the book, you saw moments where her mental limitations kind of came out, and Miss Tina would feel kind of suffocated a little bit. And it got to the point where, like, as a teenager, she pretty much was like, I've had enough, and moved to California for a period of time and eventually came back. But as much as I know Miss Tina felt the love of her mother, they clashed sometimes, especially as she got older. But honestly, it's beautiful to read their relationship as mother-daughter. And honestly, I think the title Matriarch is not just the title of the book, it is a theme of the book, as far as I've read so far, and I'm sure it's going to continue. I wanted to dive a little deeper by reading the end of the prelude. I wanted to dive a little deeper by reading the end of the prelude, just the last couple of paragraphs, which I think pretty much encapsulate the whole prelude. From my first breath, I was told, shown, and embraced into knowing that it is an honor to be a Black person. My mother saw to that, making sure I carry all these mothers with me. Rosalie, who had Celestine, who had Odelia, who had Agnes, who had me, who had Beyoncé and Solange. This is not simply about a bloodline. I watched my mama mother children who were not hers by birth. I have mothered children, like my daughters Kelly and Angie, who are as much my daughters as if I carried them. We all have this power to be matriarchs, to be women of the sacred practice of nurturing, guiding, protecting, foreseeing, and remembering. The matriarch's wisdom is ancient, for she is filled with the most endearing, ferocious love. When my oldest daughter was born, my mother had just died, and it was inconceivable to me that she would not be there to show me how to be a mother. I wanted my mother to be the one to tell my daughter these stories of all the mothers that overcame incredible odds to be with each other. My firstborn daughter looks so much like my mom, more like her than me. But that is genetics. How would I pass on our spirit, that unspoken knowing, the pride of our history? So my first gift to my daughter would be my name, Beyoncé. It didn't matter how it was spelled when it was given to me. It was our name, our history, the most valuable possession I had, and it was now mine to give. I've kept a word going. So I think that excerpt in the prelude, you know, not even knowing what was coming, really is a thread throughout this book, you know, what I've read so far. Just all the women in the bloodline, all the women that have come before Miss Tina Knowles' mom, Miss Tina, Beyoncé, and Solange, and now Blue Ivy and her daughter Rumi. Like, it has just kept going. And it's really feels like a privilege, honestly, to just have all this context that Miss Tina has given us to and paint such a full picture of their history. Like, she even includes like a very elaborate family tree in this book, which is very interesting to kind of go through and see. And she shares pictures from, like, you know, major moments in her life. So it's been an experience to read this book. And I'm excited to continue and finish and give my thoughts, you know, for the second half. I feel like there's a lot that happened in her life from when she was a kid to when she became an adult. But for this episode, I really just wanted to hit on a couple of high points. I talk about how her relationship with her mother is, honestly, I would say the backbone of this book so far, as far as what I've read. So you could imagine that her losing her mother would change her. And she says it. She says it in the prelude, the portion that I've just read, how she never thought her mother would not be here to see her babies and meet them and love on them the way she loved on her and pass down the stories and the lessons and the gems of wisdom and knowledge. And it is such a pivotal moment in the book when her mother dies, because her mom, actually, even as strong as she was throughout part one, she, in the background, battles with what I would call a chronic illness. I'm not remembering if they actually name the illness in the book, but she would just, every once in a while, just be in the hospital and just need extra medical support and just be so drained and weak and would have to go to the hospital and, you know, kind of get back to baseline health-wise and then come out. But, you know, as the kids got older and they started building their own lives and moving away, I think, interestingly enough, I think despite her being ill throughout their childhood, I think her being so busy child rearing and just keeping the fabric of their family together made it so that, this is just my opinion, made it so that her illness did not overwhelm and overcome her. But as they got older, as Miss Tina got older and her brothers and her sister, you know, grew up, high school, went about their, you know, separate ways as, you know, young adults. They were homeless. Her parents could not be part of the details and minutiae of their daily life the way they were as parents of children and adolescents. So I think, honestly, having less involvement in her children's life might have allowed, unfortunately, for the illness to take deeper root and manifest more physically in her body. That's just a theory. So with everything culminating in her passing at the end of part one, you really feel like a part of Miss Tina's story is ending and beginning at the same time. And I'm going to read it. I'm going to read that part. It's pages 138 to 139. I remember getting to the end of part one where her mom dies, and I'm like, wow. Like, I felt like I had ended a major phase in Miss Tina's life with her mom's death. And I would like to think, you know, she intended it to feel that way because it's her mom. It's her mom. Like, how do you even move on after that? And yet you do. And yet you do. When her mom died, she had already gotten married to Matthew Knowles. So a part of a new phase of her life was beginning, but now literally her foundation is shaken because her matriarch, her mother, like the person, is no more. So I will read that part of the book. It's literally the end of part one, and then part two begins. Johnny and I took her to John Seeley Hospital, and she was so light and fragile over our arms as we helped her walk, practically carrying her. When she lost her balance and fell, we caught her, but not before my heart broke. They admitted her, and a nurse told me that she was in her final hours. It is shocking that I was shocked, I know. But you have to understand that my mother had been counted out so many times and bounced back. Illness had lurked behind her my whole life, and together we'd kept it from taking her. I wasn't ready to give in. And neither was she. When my mother did talk, it was not to us, but to someone we could not see. God, give me a little more time, she repeated over and over, all day and all night. Lord, have mercy. Give me a little more time. That was Tuesday, and she stayed relatively stable with the assistance of machines. We thought she was waiting for my brother Butch, because at the time he was stationed overseas in London. Flo kept telling me, trying to prepare me with the wisdom of a nurse, Mama is hanging on for Butch to get here. But Butch got there Wednesday, and while they had a meaningful reunion, my mother then whispered, Larry. My unpredictable brother had disappeared again. Skip finally found Larry and brought him to the hospital that Thursday. He did not stay long, but when he left, I watched her exhale through the oxygen tubes. My brother was the missing piece, I told myself. She just loves her some Larry. And then her litany started again. Lord, give me a little more time. Please, God. Later that Thursday afternoon, a doctor asked me to step outside her room. I want you to understand something, he said. Every breath your mother is taking is like her running up 10 flights of stairs. She's really suffering. You've got to let go. I didn't know how. Not when she was begging God for more time. I hadn't left her side, reclining one of the hospital chairs to turn it into the bed the size of a love seat. If somebody came to visit, I would lie down on my bed to sleep briefly, then grab a cup of coffee from the machine before they left. I was afraid that my mother would die without me there. I would fail her. That Thursday night, as midnight turned to July 4th, Flo's mother-in-law, Miss Camilla, came in. "I'm gonna stay up here with you," she said, and I was so polite, I didn't know how to tell her that I didn't want her up here. I only wanted to be with my mom. She sat on my bed, and I was annoyed with her taking up space. "I can't even lie down," I thought. "She's getting on my nerves. Why she don't leave?" Reluctantly, I made room for Miss Camilla on my chair, so much that I had to lean on my mother's bed. Then I put my head down, touching the crown of my head to her side so we could feel the sureness of each other. Sleep took me, the deep soul sleep of a baby in her mother's bed. The next thing I knew, Miss Camilla was waking me just before 5 a.m. "She's gone," she said. I looked up and my mother looked so peaceful. It was painful, but the same peace filled me. "I came because your mama wouldn't have died with you looking at her," Miss Camilla told me. "It was time. I wanted to be here with her holding her hand through that transition. You had to let her go." Flo came and she agreed with her mother-in-law. We kept saying she was waiting on Butch, then Larry, but Teenie, she was waiting on you and you wouldn't go home. My sister thought I wouldn't understand, and I was surprised that I was not as devastated as I thought I would be. Since I was a little kid, I remember my mom being sick and never being truly at rest unless her kids were in her arms' reach or when she lost herself in making something beautiful. I felt her now, free of all that, with us no matter where we went and arranging beautiful things for all of her beloved. Now we were all living on our mother's prayers. Mama had joined her mother and her mother's mother. She was now with all the mothers, the ones she could name under the pecan tree, and the ones who came before them, all of them, watching over us. I started the new year feeling nauseous, not only in the morning, but all day. I missed my period and just knew. The doctor confirmed what was already sure in my heart. I was pregnant. Yeah, that's the end of part one. That is when Miss Tina Knoll's mother dies. A very pivotal moment in the book. And honestly, it very much felt like we were not only closing a chapter in a book, not only closing a chapter in this book, but just, I don't even know how to describe it. Just a tectonic shift in her being as a person, as a woman, you know, her mother finally passing. And it's being so final because she had battled this illness for so long. But now there was, it was real. It was real. She was no longer there with them in the physical presence. Like she said, she had gone on to be with their mothers and was now getting to know herself, Miss Tina, as someone with a mother no longer in the physical realm, but in the spiritual realm. So, yeah, I think I'll move on a little bit. I just want to talk quickly about how much I enjoyed the beginning of the chapter Headliners. Headliners was the name of Miss Tina's beauty shop that she opened as her own business to start to make a name for herself, to start to support herself. Because at this point, she had had Beyoncé, she had had Solange. Solange was much younger. In fact, Miss Tina had taken Solange to Matthew's mother, her mother-in-law, for a period of time because she had to really focus on the launch. She was getting down to the wire and she needed to launch the salon. So Beyoncé's schedule was a little easier to work around. She was a little older. She was going to school, but Solange was still a baby. And working on the launch of the salon while taking care of her was a lot. So she recruited her mother-in-law, who stepped in and took her for an extended period of time. She didn't see Solange for a little while because her mother-in-law was in Alabama. So that's where Solange stayed for a period. But yeah, as I was reading her getting ready to, you know, have the grand opening, I just felt so proud. I just felt so proud of her as a woman, even during this time. This is, let me see, Headliners is in the 80s. The chapter is dated October 1986. So, you know, this is a period of time in Houston, I believe, where this Black woman is starting her own business and is betting on herself, which is a theme for myself this year and something I talked about on the last episode. And she is doing everything in a way that is super intentional and purposeful and so inspiring to me. I think I'm going to end this episode by just reading the first couple pages of Headliners so you guys can get a really good idea of what I'm talking about and why I felt so proud of this woman at this time in her life, having lost her mother, having had two kids, dealing with some tumult in her marriage, because at this point, Matthew would go through phases of just blatant infidelity, and it really fractured them to the point where Miss Tina actually left for a period of time. She stayed with her friend, Marlene, eventually went back home, but kind of had enough to a degree where she was like, I don't know how long this marriage is going to last. I don't know how long we will be together, but I don't want to find myself in a situation where I can't support myself and I can't support my kids. So that was a major motivating factor from what I can see of her starting Headliners. So let me just read this excerpt from that chapter, and I think I will end the podcast here for part one. Yeah, it's been a great read so far, and I'm looking forward to finishing the book and talking more about it in part two. So this is Headliners. This is page 174. And it is dated October 1986. I placed the last flyer under the windshield wiper so the 995 showed just right above the name of my salon, Headliners Hair Salon for the Professional Woman. I'd hit every car parked at the light company, saying a little prayer with each one. The street marketing team Matthew hired was doing a blitz of advertising in the last week before Headliners opened, but I wanted to be hands-on about it. I'd given them a list of places to target where I knew a lot of women worked. The ladies at the light, gas, and water companies, and post offices too, needed to be cordially invited to the opening, to the grand opening of Headliners, so I could get buzz going. We also focused on other professional women, doctors, lawyers, and Cheryl's network of Black women in finance. The flyer offered a $9.95 shampoo and blow dry and reconstructive treatment for the first time visit only. Matthew's idea for a can't resist deal that would get people in the door. The stylists I hired didn't like me for that. This was a $30 value. Plus, I told them we would throw in a trim if the client needed it. The women we drew in would love how they looked, and their happiness was a great marketing tool. We would have a customer for life. We'll lose a little money up front, I said, but sometimes you have to give a little to get a lot. I could do that because I was confident in the service we would provide and the power of deep conditioning. We catered to professional women, and I didn't feel bad about it. Anybody could come if you could afford it, but it wasn't cheap. And that's because I respected that their time wasn't cheap. Every woman I talked to hated that they'd sit in a salon for 5 hours, eating lunch under a dryer, listening to gossip, when they had a job or kids to get back to. I had found my niche, the consumer need that is vital to a new business, time and respect. At the grand opening, all the worry paid off. There was a march of heels on the tile floor I put in. Women who begged to be squeezed in, but I had to schedule for the next day. And when that was full, the next day, and then the one after that. As Denise took each woman's information, the clients marveled at the computer system I'd put in. It was Matthew's idea to put everyone on file in the database, which was unheard of in salons at the time. This would ensure that each client would feel important and remembered when she returned, because the secret of good branding is belonging. The person greeting her would know when she was last in for a perm, and if she preferred red or white when we offered her our complimentary glass of wine on arrival. We would even know how she took her coffee, and we were famous for the gourmet brew we offered, which was just regular with a scoop of Texas vanilla bluebell ice cream. Someone would always be at the ready to lead her to the dressing room to put on her smock, a gorgeous pink that leveled the playing field for all our clients. A doctor would be next to an opera singer performing that night at the Wortham Theater Center on Texas Avenue. And next to them would be an up-and-comer spending a bit of her first or second paycheck to look and feel good. There was no class system at the salon, no private green room that a VIP was whisked to. Everyone was special under the dryer. I only used high-end products, but I married the science of hair care innovation with the ritual of what my mother had passed down to me. Looking at a client, I could hear the voice of Agnes and how many times she told me, "You need to grease some of your hair because it looks dry." Most often, she used olive oil, heating it up to do a hot oil treatment, then wrapping it in a towel. She would also use butter and mayonnaise to nourish the hair, egg whites to make it stronger. "You've got to get to the root," she would tell me. "You can make the hair as strong as you want, Tina, but it will pull right out if it's not strong at the root." At Headliners, I became a mixologist, honoring what had worked in the past, but modernizing the methods. There was no one product that mixed high-tech hair care with the moisture and oils that are so important to textured or color-treated hair. In fact, they said a Black woman could choose a perm for her hair or color, but not both. I proved them wrong. I created my own protein treatments, making the hair stronger for curling, heating, and braiding, especially for clients choosing perms or color. Then I would work to balance all that protein with the moisture each client required, providing hydration and shine without weighing her hair down. Some stylists I'd meet would never reveal their secrets, but I wanted to share as my mother had done. It would sometimes unlock stories in the clients about grandmothers and great-grandmothers doing their hair as little girls, the feel of their fingers on their scalp, caring for them. Hairstyling is more than the act of doing hair. It's how a mother's love is transferred through that care. We got our stylist right out of beauty school, so no one developed bad habits. I did not care how it was done at another salon. This was Headliners. As we expanded our hours, we let new staffers know the culture of the salon before they were even considered for a station. This is not a place of judgment or gossip. If you were caught gossiping, you were fired. I would end up letting go of some people I really liked, but we just couldn't have that kind of atmosphere. Because the next thing you knew, everyone would be fighting and backstabbing. The staff started calling themselves Tina's Girls, and they became an extension of my family. I had so much mother love to give that I wanted them to reach their full potential. The ones that worked at Headliners were taking home $1,500 to $2,000 a week, unheard of in the late 80s. They were often making more than the women who could afford their services, and it allowed for a feeling of mutual respect. Being my own boss, I could think of exciting ways to help them. We had a psychologist come in to do talks that would motivate them to pursue goals. If it took them away from Headliners, that was okay. Some went back to school. One of our best, Tony Smith, started as a shampoo girl, and when I quickly realized she could do anything she set her mind to, I encouraged her to get her license to cut hair. Succeeding at that, she then got her bachelor's, then her master's, and then ran for political office. I was so proud that so many Headliners graduates would later go on to become salon owners themselves. So, just a glimpse into what it took for her to launch that salon, the blood, sweat, and tears she put into it, the culture and atmosphere she wanted to promote, the type of people she hired, how she wanted her clients to feel. All of those factors contributed to the success. And it just makes me feel inspired. It makes me feel motivated. It makes me feel proud. You know, a Black woman in the 1980s doing her thing, making bank. Because clearly the stylists were doing well, so I'm sure she was doing well too. Making a name for herself. Just all the things, really. And I think it's particularly relevant to me at this point in my life, because I see us on similar paths. It's not one-to-one. It's not like a mirror image, but similar paths. You know, she has young kids. Beyonce is maybe about 5 at this time, 5 or 6. Solange is much younger. Here I am about to have my first kid. She is starting her own business, which is proving to be successful. I am venturing out on myself, you know, for myself to a degree. I'm starting slower, but very much still betting on myself the way she bet on herself. Seeing success materialize and me knowing that will be the case for myself. It's just knowing that it's a reminder that, you know, if she can do it, I can do it. And you guys have heard the little bit that I've read, her history, where she came from, the most monumental moment in her life, her mom passing, and now starting essentially a new life with her mom no longer being with her, and forging on. So I'm very excited to continue reading and finishing and, you know, discussing part 2 in March. I want to thank you guys for listening. I appreciate you so much. As always, please reach out to me at contact@thelettersandlayers.com. Rate and review on your preferred listening platform. Give your girl 5 stars. You know we deserve it. Follow us on Instagram @thelettersandlayerspod. Subscribe to the YouTube channel. And thank you again. I appreciate you all so much. And I'll talk to you in the next one. Bye.